It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, March 24th, 2024. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Israel's prime minister says they're going after Hamas in the heavily populated town of Rafah. But the Biden administration's urging caution and still expecting Israel to make its case at the White House this week.
We're going to sit there and we're going to talk to them about some of our perspectives, and we're going to share with them some viable options here that hopefully give them pause to think about Rafah operations in a different way.
I'm Jared Halpern. The Veep Stakes is underway, giving us weeks of drama over who former President Trump will tap as his running mate.
Vice presidential candidates don't necessarily win elections, but the pick of the wrong one can help lose it.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. A delegation from Israel is supposed to come to the White House this week ahead of Israel's promise to go after Hamas in an area of Gaza called Rafah. It is full of civilians. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said from Egypt, next to the country's foreign minister, what the priorities are right now.
Ceasefire, release of hostages, humanitarian assistance, and a clear pathway and plan for the future.
He said last week that when they speak to the Israeli delegation this week, he hopes
to make clear why we think it would be a mistake to engage in major military operations in Rafah, but also why there's a false choice involved, that it is possible and indeed necessary to deal with the ongoing threat posed by Hamas, but without a major military operation. That's what we want to discuss.
Egypt's foreign minister said he thought a double standard was being applied to the Palestinian cause, that the moral basis upon which they can rely on a world order are being strained here.
This should be recognized as a severe challenge to our ability to work together, to continue to cooperate on a predictable set of principles.
All of that was Thursday. Friday, Blinken met with Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, whom our Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer recently called an obstacle in the war. He also called for new elections in Israel. Netanyahu says he told Blinken that Israel's grateful for U.S. support, and that he recognizes the need to evacuate civilians from battle zones.
I also said that we have no other way to defeat Hamas without going into Rafah and eliminate the remaining Hamas battalions. I also told him I hope we will do it with the support of the U.S., but if we have to, we will do it alone.
Friday, the U.S. proposed resolution for an immediate ceasefire, along with a release of hostages, failed at the U.N. Security Council with vetoes from Russia and China. They said there should be a ceasefire regardless of the hostages. It is not the first time a U.S. resolution regarding the war between Israel and Hamas has been vetoed.
The hope is that we can get the hostages out.
John Kirby is the White House National Security Communications Advisor.
And the hope is that we can get a 6-week ceasefire in place so that the violence can come down, so that more aid can get in to Gaza.
Why does the U.N. need to be a part of it, though?
We believe it's important for the United Nations and for the international community to stand up for all the same things that are so important to the people of Gaza and to the Israeli people. I mean, this resolution that we submitted also included a condemnation of Hamas. No other resolution prior to the one that we submitted was willing to go as far as condemning Hamas for what they did on the 7th of October. So we believe it's important that the international community speak with one voice about what matters here and what we should all be pushing for.
Israel's prime minister, as you know, said after meeting with Secretary Blinken that he appreciates the U.S. support. He hopes it continues. But there is no scenario in which Hamas is eliminated without Israel going into Rafah. And if they have to do that, they'll do it alone. But we all know a delegation is supposed to be coming to the White House.
That's right.
With what? To present a plan? I mean, what's happening? Will Israel wait until after it's presented the White House a plan?
I think you'd have to ask the Israelis about their military plans. I'm certainly not going to get into talking about that for them. What I can say is that we still don't support a major ground operation in Rafah, certainly not one that doesn't properly account for the 1.5 million Gazan refugees who are are in Rafah because of operations that happened to the north in previous weeks. There's got to be a plan to make sure that we can ensure their safety and security. And a major ground offensive right now, as we've said, would be a disaster. So we've invited this delegation to Washington, D.C. They'll be here soon. We look forward to discussing with them some of our lessons learned and perspectives in urban warfare and dense environments, and sharing with them some other alternatives that they should be considering before they move in a major and conduct some sort of major ground operation.
We see Secretary Blinken, and I know you're not state, but we see Secretary Blinken meeting with officials from Egypt, with the Jordanians, with the Qataris. Is there any pressure on them, especially Jordan and Egypt, rather than Israel, to say, you know, if you care so much about Palestinian civilians, why aren't you letting them in? I thought in global affairs, that's what happens, is the nearby countries who are sympathetic would open their doors.
Well, we don't want any sort of forced relocation of the Gazan of Gazan Palestinians outside Gaza. And most folks in Gaza don't want to leave because they're concerned about if they left, would they be able to get back in? And we are talking to our counterparts every single day about what they can do to help increase the flow of humanitarian assistance. That includes Jordan. That includes Egypt. That includes our other Gulf partners. I mean, this is a constant conversation that we're having with them.
If Kirby, if this delegation comes to the White House before any effort happens in Rafah, do we expect somebody at the White House, maybe even the president, to sign off on some plan or make some statement after the delegation's left? And is there a risk there? Because if there's any White House approved plan, does that mean the administration gets blamed?
Now hang on just a second here.
I mean, how far are we going in terms of being involved in what Israel's doing?
There's an awful lot to that question. So let me just try to break it down here. Israel is a sovereign nation, and they were attacked on the 7th of October in the most horrific of ways. They have every right and a responsibility to look after their own security and to eliminate the threat that is posed by Hamas, a group that wants to do October 7th all over again. And you know what? We're still helping them with the kinds of capabilities that they need to do that. We are not dictating their operations to them. We are not making operational decisions for them. We are, and have, I might add, since October of last year, have been providing our lessons learned and our perspectives about this kind of warfare, lessons that we learned in some very painful ways over the last 20 plus years in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it wouldn't be right for a friend of Israel, as we are, not to share those lessons learned. And so we look forward to having the delegation here next week. We're going to sit there and we're going to talk to them about some of our perspectives, and we're going to share with them some viable options here that hopefully give them pause to think about Rafah operations in a different way.
Okay.
And not necessarily go in, you know, in a major ground offensive with 1.5 million people that are facing potential starvation here and desperate need of humanitarian assistance.
But you talk about lessons learned. That's a really important point, because if we are sharing that with Israel, then what is the lesson? How is Israel supposed to go into Rafah when Hamas, which is the target, is using Palestinians as human shields, and there's still a tunnel network? I mean,
you're right. That makes it really, really hard, doesn't it? Because Hamas is not abiding by any kind of international rule of law here or law of war. They are sheltering behind civilians. It has made things very difficult for the Israelis. And it's not just that they're hiding behind civilians. It's that they're doing it in such a densely urban populated, highly populated environment. Gaza is a tiny strip with a lot of people living in it, and Hamas is using that to their advantage. That's what makes this so difficult. And that's even why it's more important for us to share with the Israelis, our thinking on this, our perspectives, as we have since the very beginning of the conflict. But ultimately, it's their decision to make. And this narrative out there that I've heard that we're dictating terms to them, or we're telling them how to conduct their operations, is just bunk. It's just not true. We've never done that, and we're not going to start doing that. That said, we've learned valuable lessons, and as a friend and an ally of Israel, we feel it's incumbent upon us to share those lessons with them, so that they can do this in a way that doesn't put that 1.5 million people at greater danger.
You mentioned aid and that people in Gaza are starving. You know, every time I hear aid discussed, reporters say, what are you doing to get Palestinians aid? Israel's the problem. Israel's blocking the aid. So I'll take the flip side of that here, because Israel says it's absolutely not blocking aid, that Hamas is getting in the way, that looting is happening. We've seen videos on social media. Israel is even supporting this idea of a port to get aid in. It's interesting to hear Israel being blamed for the aid not getting in. So but then what is the solution here to getting aid in?
Well, there have been a lot of challenges about getting aid in, a lot. It's a war zone. Before the October attacks, there was 500 some odd trucks getting into Gaza every day because there wasn't a lot of fighting. Well, now there's fighting, and just being a war zone makes it hard to get trucks moving. There are checkpoints they have to get through. That is true. There have been some resistance on the Israeli side at certain crossings at certain times to allow stuff in. We've worked that out with our Israeli counterparts. We're continuing to work that out with our Israeli counterparts. We have taken on the role of doing some airdrops. It's not anywhere near enough, and it's not going to supplement what you can get in by trucks, but we're still dropping things from the air. And you're right. Now we are moving by sea a temporary pier to try to see if we can find another avenue, a maritime avenue, to get aid in. There's a lot of work being done by a lot of folks, but there's a lot of challenges that have prevented aid from getting in.
Just a couple more for you. We know after Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's speech about Israel, you know, he's saying Netanyahu's the block to peace. There at least one block to peace. He said the fourth, right? And there needs to be new elections when the war winds down, quote unquote. We know the president said it was a good speech. He kept his comments brief on that. But it does seem like, and we have Fox News polling on this, it does seem like there's a divide among Democrats about supporting Israel versus supporting Palestinians. Is there a possibility in this Democratic administration, I don't even know if you can answer this, but is there a possibility that Israel loses funding or has funding cut or some funding cut if they're not on the same page with the United States?
Well, look, I'm not going to talk about Democratic politics one way or the other. That's not my place here at the National Security Council. I can tell you that you talked about support for Israel, support for Palestinians, and almost like it's a sort of a balance equation or you know, it's a binary choice. We don't view it that way. We're going to continue to support Israel. We are providing them weapons and capabilities. That support continues. They have a right to defend themselves, and they need our help to do that. We don't want to see October 7th happen again. On the same token, we all have, the international community has an obligation to alleviate the suffering of the people of Gaza. They have lost tens of thousands of their friends and loved ones, tens of thousands more injured and wounded in this conflict. They didn't ask for this. They weren't the ones storming that concert on the 7th of October. Hamas doesn't represent them or their aspirations. They need help, and the United States is going to continue to be a world leader in doing what we can to get them the food, water, medicine, and fuel that they need. You can do both. A country as big and as powerful as us, it has to be able to do both, and that's what the president is focused on.
Finally, we heard from Secretary Blinken after meeting with Egypt's foreign minister, a lot of mentions, a ceasefire, no immediate ground invasion of Rafah, the release of the hostages, humanitarian aid, even reforms to the PA. And it does get you thinking about the future. I know that there's a war. You said it's a war zone. But when we hear the secretary speak about a future and we see Mahmoud Abbas of the PA appointing, I think it's a prime minister, right, who has extensive experience with Gaza, is the future here the PA running Gaza? I mean, I know we don't know, but what are we sort of thinking?
Almost again, since the beginning of the conflict, we've been focused on a post-conflict future for Gaza and for the Palestinian people who live there. And this is something Secretary Blinken has spearheaded for the administration. And you heard him on this most recent trip talking about post-conflict Gaza. It's very much been on his mind. And we still believe in the promise of a two-state solution. And the president continues to believe that that's in the best interest, not just of the Palestinian people, but for the Israeli people as well. A two-state solution with Israel's security guaranteed. And one of the ways we believe that you can get to that is a revitalized Palestinian Authority. And this gets to your direct question. We have seen Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority make some personnel changes that have been welcome, that have been indicative of the degree to which they are trying to move the PA forward. And we believe that that is the one of the key parts, key components of being able to get post-conflict Gaza governed in a way that doesn't present a threat to the Israeli people or to the Israeli nation, but also does a better job looking after the aspirations of the Gazan people than what Hamas has done. Back to the question you asked me a little bit ago, which was a really good one and a fair one. They are hiding behind these civilians. They are making them targets. There's been fighting over the Al-Shifa hospital because they are still using the hospital to shelter and to fight Israeli ground forces there. I mean, this is them putting the people of Gaza at greater risk, and they clearly don't have the Palestinian people best interests in mind. And what we believe is that we need whatever governance looks like in Gaza. And you're right, I can't give you the exact answer, but whatever it looks like, it can't be Hamas, number one. And two, it's got to start with at least a revitalized Palestinian Authority that can, again, properly govern and look after those aspirations.
White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Anytime.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Is your March Madness bracket already busted? If so, no worries. You can now spend your time on another American tradition of making picks, the Veep Stakes. With former President Donald Trump securing the delegates needed for the Republican nomination, the next major touchstone in this election season and his campaign will be who he picks as a running mate. Every week, it seems, new names emerge as potential vice presidential nominees, leaving the impression the shortlist may not be all that short. Who a nominee selects as his or her running mate usually comes down to strategy, trying to make up gaps in, say, experience or voting blocks or even geographic appeal. Karl Rove, a former deputy chief of staff and senior advisor to President George W. Bush, says the selection also provides a window into a candidate's thinking.
In a conventional campaign, this would have already started. The process of vetting your potential nominee would have already begun, even if the primaries had yet to go on for a while. But it really depends on the instincts and the priorities of the candidate. The first priority from a political perspective is what can be done to help put the ticket in the best chance of winning the fall election. Vice presidential candidates don't necessarily win elections, but the pick of the wrong one can help lose it. What you need to do is start by making certain that you unite the party and that you fill in any problem areas that might hurt you coming down the stretch. For example, in 2008, you had the young, brash Barack Obama, who had been literally a member of the United States Senate for 4 years and had no international experience. And so they picked a senior Democrat who'd been at one point the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Joe Biden. You know, you know, 2008, the same election, John McCain was trying to figure out how to energize the Republican Party. And so he ended up picking Sarah Palin. 1980, Ronald Reagan demonstrated his bigness as a candidate and as a potential president by saying, I'm going to pick my principal opponent in the Republican primaries so that I can unite the party and go into the general election with everybody excited about having a piece of the ticket. So you start by trying to at least create no harm by having somebody on the ticket who's going to hurt you. That they're not going to help you a lot, but if you make the wrong pick, it can hurt you a lot because it can show a weakness that you've not attempted to fill.
So as we look at former President Trump, obviously, I guess the quote from their spokesperson was the short list is pretty long. I guess we'll just call it a list then. But obviously, unifying the party is still something I think that they are focused on. Right. When you look at even if it's not a huge number, the number of Republicans who voted for somebody other than Donald Trump in these Republican primaries and the number of those who have indicated a level of uncomfortability with Donald Trump as the nominee.
Well, first of all, he is the incumbent. I mean, we forget that we haven't been in this position since, you know, like 1892 on the Democratic side. You know, Grover Cleveland coming back to try and win back the presidency from Benjamin Harrison. But he is, in essence, the incumbent. So the fact that somebody was getting 30% and nearly 40% in the primaries is problematic. But what would be even more problematic if to anybody sitting inside that cockpit right now is that even after Nikki Haley got out, 15 to 20% of the people in these recent primaries voted for her or somebody else. And that's a problem because, again, he was the president of the United States as a Republican, and he's running again for his party's nomination. And even after nobody is opposing him, one out of every five people who turned out to vote in the last set of primaries, or one out of six, said, I'm not voting for the guy. So, yes, he's got to unite the party, and really critical for him.
So the other part that's fascinating about that is the last person he picked as his running mate in former Vice President Mike Pence, who I think was also kind of a pick to try and consolidate the conservative base who were still kind of hesitant about Donald Trump. That's not the dynamic now. But Mike Pence hasn't endorsed his former running mate and doesn't seem inclined to ever do so. Does that complicate the ability to kind of bring somebody in who can unify the Republican Party?
Yeah, well, yeah, it is a complicating factor. I mean, look, think about the members of the former president's cabinet who've not endorsed him and won't. Mm-hmm. I mean, anybody think Rex Tillerson, former Secretary of State, is going to come out enthusiastically for Donald Trump, or that, you know, that's just not going to happen? And what's interesting to me is most of the time a vice presidential nominee can help you avoid problems, but is not a great, you know, sort of advantage to one ticker to the other. But the vice president for each side is going to be critical. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who are saying that I've run into who say, look, I liked what Donald Trump did, but I don't like him personally. But I do not want Kamala Harris to be president. And I worry about that as a prospect because Joe Biden is 81. He'll be 82 by the time of the next inaugural if it's elected. So Trump, on the other hand, has people who say, you know what, I don't like him. I may have liked some of his policies. I really am not going to vote for Biden, but he can cement them. He gives a better chance of winning those people if he's got somebody who says, you know, well, you know what, Tim Scott strikes me as a good man, and that's a solid individual. So just like Mike Pence helped him in 2020 unite the Republican Party by bringing in more evangelicals and Midwesterners, and frankly, candidly, I suggested it to the former president back in 2016, May of 2016, I think it was. I met with him after the Indiana primary, a mutual, you know, somebody who knew him took me to a meeting with him, and my friend and his friend, then candidate Trump asked him, who should I pick? And he gave a suggestion of somebody, which I didn't think, you know, I didn't agree with. And when Trump turned to me and said, what do you think? I said, I know you, I like the idea of having somebody from the Midwest, but, you know, you might want to think about the governor of Indiana. He wasn't for you, but he didn't attack you. He was for Ted Cruz, and he represents a more conservative wing of the party, and the evangelicals like him a lot. And he's a Midwestern governor, and Indiana has the highest percentage of manufacturing jobs in the country. So if you're making a pitch for the blue-collar worker, He comes in from a state where the Republicans have made a tradition of being able to appeal to working class people who are in the plant, various kinds of plants and manufacturing facilities in the state, and winning them. So, you know, again, Trump has got to figure out, does he want to have somebody who makes him feel good, you know, as somebody who, you know, has sort of, you know, star power. And but the main thing is that he feels their loyalty and that they're strongly for him personally. Or does he pick somebody who is obviously for him, but allows but that other people would see as broadening his appeal and bringing in, you know, being basically a bouquet that tossed in the direction of the people who said, you know, I'm not voting for him, even if he's the only guy left on the in the primary.
Do you think he's considering Nikki Haley?
Well, look, I don't see he's not Ronald Reagan. He just isn't big enough to say I'm going to pick George H.W. Bush. You know, I'm going to pick Nikki Haley. But the question is he thinking about, you know, somebody like, say, a Kristi Noem, or is he thinking about a Tim Scott?
You know, and I've heard both of those names. The other thing that I've kind of the conventional wisdom out there is that, you know, the ticket is looking for a woman, given obviously the role that abortion is expected to play in this race, given that that is a demographic that the former president has kind of underperformed traditionally with other Republican candidates. What's your view on that?
Adding a woman onto the ticket is not going to solve that problem. What's going to solve that problem is having a presidential candidate who can articulate a message about abortion that's got several components. One, empathy. You know, understanding that this is a tough decision. Two, reasonableness, that they are in favor of, as President Trump has indicated. You know, look, we ought to recognize that there ought to be limits, and there ought to be a period of a reasonable period of time in which a woman can make that decision and abort the child. And 15 or 16 weeks seems to be reasonable. That there need to be exceptions: rape, incest, life of the mother. And there needs to be the decision that, you know, parents ought to be involved in the decision of their teenage daughters. But, you know, and it ought to be left up to the states, that, you know, as opposed to a simple federal answer. I think the one point that helped Nikki Haley a lot during the primaries was she sounded like the adult on that stage. We're not going to get 60 votes in the U.S. Senate for any kind of abortion law. Better to leave this up to the states, as we in the pro-life movement have been talking about for decades, and as the Supreme Court clearly pointed to. So I think it matters more how Donald Trump handles it than just simply adding a woman to the ticket.
The other, I guess the new name out there now, at least this week, is Marco Rubio, a former rival politically of Donald Trump once upon a time. I think that's all water under the bridge at this point. But, you know, he's somebody who would bring that foreign policy experience, given his tenure in the Senate. I don't know if we count Florida sort of as a swing state so much anymore, but that's an interesting name that I had not considered until I heard it kind of reported this week.
Well, it's no longer a swing state because people like Ron DeSantis and Marco Rubio changed the state. And the advantage there is that he would have an appeal in the Hispanic communities, and there's not just one Hispanic or Latino community. Right. There are multiple ones, and he comes out of the Cuban American experience, but also, interestingly enough, spent part of his childhood in Nevada, which is going to be a battleground state where Latinos are a critical voting block. And his life experience of being the, you know, son of a bartender and a hotel maid allows him to, you know, to form a bond that could be particularly powerful. And I've seen it, and saw it in his presidential race. We've seen it in his races in Florida. You know, he knows what it's like to start out, you know, on the shabby side of the middle class and work your way up. And his parents were great examples to him. And that is one of the things that I think would make him particularly powerful in the Hispanic communities.
How much, I'm just curious, you would know this better than I, is there an electoral problem with him picking somebody from Florida? Like, one of them would have to move, right? Wasn't that like, didn't that come up with Dick Cheney?
Yeah, that's a 12th Amendment problem, yes. Yeah, Donald Trump's voting residence is now in Florida as opposed to New York, and that would be a problem. So the Democrats would have the same problem if Joe Biden were not running with Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris.
That's right.
He's governor of California. She's the former U.S. senator from California, and which one of them is going to change their voting residence? That's a problem.
It's not an immovable object. I was just curious. I know that's something that once upon a time, I think the Bush ticket had to deal with, right?
Exactly. Now, the 12th Amendment, just for our listeners who don't know what these two political nerds are talking about, you cannot cast the votes of a state for a president and a vice presidential candidate from that state. This was passed in 1801 after the election of 1800 ended in a tie in the Electoral College. And it was an attempt to make certain that in the, you know, the small number of states we then had, I think there were 16 or 17 states, that that you didn't have political power concentrated in one state. And yes, in 2000, George W. Bush decided that he was going to pick the guy who was in charge of the process of vetting nine people that we were looking at. We had to have Cheney. Fortunately, Cheney had lived in Wyoming, been a congressman.
Served in Congress from Wyoming. Yeah, he had roots there.
Had a residence in Wyoming, but he was then living in Dallas, running Halliburton, the world's largest oil field service company. But we had to have him go back to Wyoming and on a Friday morning re-register so that he could be announced the following week as the running mate, and the 12th Amendment problem had gone away.
So again, not immovable, but it is something that to think about as we look at these different things.
Exactly.
Thrown about. Let me finish with this, and that's kind of, you kind of talked about the challenges, obviously, with unifying, trying to find maybe where you have deficits in different voting blocks. How much do you try and find somebody? I mean, it's only one night, but that vice presidential debate, somebody who maybe has experience in that arena.
Yeah. Well, there are two moments you think about when you're thinking about the vice president. You've hit on one of them. How well are they going to perform in the vice presidential debate? The good news for the Republican nominee is that almost whoever you pick is going to by nature do a better job than Kamala Harris, who is a dreadful public speaker and dreadful in debates. But here's the other thing you need to do. You need to have somebody who can speak at the Republican National Convention, which is going to be the most watched part of the campaign outside of the debates, and make a good impression on the American people.
And somebody who certainly can you know, highlight, because whoever you have is probably going to have, at least in their history, some policy differences, right? So kind of the ability to set that aside and talk about the things that you agree on.
Right. And also talk about then who they are. I mean, look, we pick people not because we agree with them on the issues 100%, but because we broadly think that they're sort of in general agreement with us about what the big things are and what we need to do. We elect the people, though, because we think they have authenticity and that they have character and that they're going to do something that we think is, you know, vital for the country. And whether it's, you know, In 2015, 2016, you know, we wanted on the Republican side somebody who was going to take a brick and throw it through the plate glass window of American politics, and that man was Donald Trump. But, you know, now we're going to be looking at him and saying, you know, is this person up to the job? And do we think that if something terrible were to happen to the president, would we be comfortable with them stepping in? Would we have confidence in him? And this is Kamala Harris's problem. I mean, as bad as Joe Biden's numbers are, hers are worse because people can't look at her and say, yes, we have confidence that she has what it takes. Donald Trump would be well served by picking somebody that people would look at and say, well, you know, Donald Trump is running for a second term, so he's only got four more years. And he's getting up there. And who would we have confidence in if something happened, or if, you know, if in 2028?
Or to hand it off in 28.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So usually these are announced, the week before the convention. That is not until July, Carl. That is a long time from now. Right. When do you think, the former president makes his announcement?
Well, I don't know. He said he's already made a decision. If I were him, I'd get that decision out there sooner rather than later. But on the other hand, there is something useful. I mean, the drama of going through a process is useful because you're looking for reasons to have people pay attention to you. Now, it's not hard when you're Joe Biden and Donald Trump, people pay attention to you, but it is a useful way to make it not just about you, but about your thought process and about this important individual who's going to play a big role in your administration. So our convention, the Republican convention, is the middle of July. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be surprised if this didn't take him another couple of months before he decides that it's an auspicious time to roll it out. He's got his hands full right now, so I don't expect that we'll have this announced until late May or June, or maybe even the middle of June.
Well, then you and I will have plenty of time to reevaluate and have these conversations again. Carl Rove, always appreciate our chats. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
That will do it for this edition of the Fox News Rundown from Washington podcast. Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown, Arkansas Republican Brad Winstrup chairs the House panel on the coronavirus pandemic, leading an investigation of the U.S. response and the origins of the virus. He's also among the growing number of lawmakers retiring at the end of this term. He'll talk about both of those storylines. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.